Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the last of the Love Heart Centre Friday events for the term. It's also probably our most distinguished event because of the quality of the panel. And that makes up for the absence of sandwiches, but for the absence of sandwiches as well as the presence of sandwiches, we have to thank Cambridge University Press. The absence of sandwiches today is not due to any deficiency on their part, but simply to the logistics of having the talk here. The purpose of the session is to review the calendar year 2011 from the perspective of international law. And we have a panel which is absolutely capable of doing that. I'll introduce them very briefly now. You will have heard of them, and therefore my introductions can be very short. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to Cambridge Judge Shui Han Chin from the International Court of Justice. Judge Shui was very recently re-elected for a further term on the court, to the great pleasure and relief of those who appeared before her. She has previously published on transboundary pollution a book with Cambridge Studies in International Comparative Law. And she's representative of the new China in international law, a great force for good. She will be followed by Professor Françoise Hampson. Professor Hampson is one of the leading international humanitarian lawyers in the country and in the world. She's done a great deal of work with the ICRC, and as well as work as an individual scholar. And as she describes it, troublemaking in Strasbourg.
As it was described.
Producing further jurisprudence from that body. Our third speaker is, of course, I still call him new, but it's because my time span now does nothing less than decades. Professor Mark Weller, who's done a wonderful job taking over as director of the centre, whose idea this panel was. He's been working for the United Nations in various unattributable roles. But if you're interested in journalism, you should watch where he's going to be, because that's where the next government is going to fall. He has just been in Yemen. You understand he's going to Syria. He asked me to stress that nothing he says is to be taken as representing the view of the United Nations in any of its various capacities. And certainly not least, Sir Michael Wood. Sir Michael has been a great supporter of the Centre over many years. He was, of course, the legal advisor to Her Majesty's Government for a considerable term. Since then, he's been at the bar, and he and I have cross swords would be putting it rather belligerently. But we're always on opposite sides. And no doubt he'll tell you his version of the cases if we're on opposite sides. Therefore, I will say that nothing he says is to be taken as attributable to any version of the truth. He's also the British member of the International Law Commission, and we'll be speaking in the first instance about that. The order of procedure is, as I've described it, each speaker will speak for 10 minutes, except that Mark will speak for 9 minutes. He's been got to a minute on the grounds of the quality of the sandwiches. We'll then have time for questions, and I'll ask when you ask your question, if you speak clearly. I will repeat the question for the purposes of the record. This session is being recorded on videotape and will be available to be seen on the website in due course. So we start with Judge Shui Han Chin. It's wonderful to see you. You can say that if you like, we'll come to you.
Which one?
Thank you very much, Professor Crawford. At the outset, I wish to express once again my sincere appreciation to Love Heart Research Centre for inviting me to join this distinguished panel, and it's always great to be back at Cambridge. I understand Professor Crawford signed me to report the work of ICJ. In hindsight, now I understand why he asked me to come, because I'm one of the most junior judges judges on the bench. So for fresh on, maybe I'm expecting that to tell you more about the work of ICJ. As a matter of fact, the president of the court has just recently reported the work of the court to the General Assembly and the Security Council and the Sixth Committee. And so given the time limit, I will not go over all cases, but just give you a brief report of what court has done during the year. In hindsight, I have to confess, in my first year at the court, the court's work is unexpectedly busy. And so far, there are 15 cases pending on the docket. And this year, the court has delivered 4 judgments, 3 orders. And of the 4 judgments, I will start with the case, Diallo case, that the case between Republic of Guinea versus the Democratic Republic of the Congo over the claims for the injury to individual rights. And it's a kind of old form of diplomatic protection, but in this particular case, the court actually mainly address individual rights, compensation for individual rights. And this case, the court actually went to quite length discussing about expulsion of aliens, a topic currently International Law Commission is considering. So during the course of the Sixth Committee in the General Assembly, the chairman of the International Commission actually made quite emphasis on the judgment of the court in this particular case. The second judgment relating to the case filed by Georgia versus Russian Federation over the claim for Russians' alleged breach of international obligations under the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The case was pleaded mainly at the initial stage, procedural stage, for preliminary objections, and the court upheld one of the objections raised by Russia. And the third case regarding two requests for intervention by Honduras and Costa Rica, respectively, in the case on territorial and the maritime dispute between Nicaragua and Colombia. In the case of intervention raised by Costa Rica, the court came to the judgment that Costa Rica did not satisfy the conditions as laid down under Article 62 to prove that it has an interest of legal nature that may be affected by the decision of the court. And in the second case raised by Honduras, the court, Honduras in this case particularly requests for permission to intervene as a party. And if otherwise, it would like to intervene as a non-party. So this is quite different. And to my knowledge, this is the first time a party requested to intervene as a party. Similarly, the court ruled either requesting for intervention to be as a party or a non-party, the party still has to satisfy the conditions under Article 62. Namely, it has to prove it has an interest of a legal nature that may be affected by the decision of the court. So these are the 4 judgments. For the 3 orders, the first one is the case between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Costa Rica brought case against Nicaragua for a territorial dispute in the border area between the two countries on San Juan River. And Costa Rica actually filed for a request to court to indicate provisional measures given the dispute in the border area. And the court rendered the judge the order in favor of Costa Rica, but request to both parties to constrain their actions in the border region. Meanwhile, asked parties to cooperate with the Ramsar Convention Secretariat for the protection of the environment in the area. And that's that element is very important in that case. And the second order given by court is the case that Greece has asked court to indicate for permission to intervene in the case between Germany and Italy in case of jurisdictional immunity. In that case, the court granted permission. And but interesting, you may know is that in that case, rather than as court did in the previous two cases regarding intervention, in this case, court rendered an order of a procedural nature, permitting Greece to intervene in the case between Germany and Italy. Then the last one is the case filed by Cambodia versus Thailand over the for interpretation of the 1962 judgment rendered by the court in regard to Tampur Fier. And meantime, Cambodia requests the court to indicate provisional measures given the armed conflict in the border area and the tensions in the region. And the court, in this case, granted the permission and rendered the ordered the indicated provisional measures and also asked the both it defined a provisional demilitary zone in the area. Meantime, asked the parties to cooperate with the ASEAN for the settlement of the dispute. And I would emphasize, actually, in both this case, in the Temple case, and also in the case between Costa Rica and Nicaragua, for territorial dispute in the border area, regional organizations were referred to and for their role in the peaceful settlement process. And of course, in the Cambodia versus Thailand case, you may notice for the first time the court indicated a demilitarized zone that beyond the disputed area, and appoint a few judges actually indicated in their declarations and separate opinions. Apart from these judgments and orders, I have to emphasize there are other ongoing cases. Particularly, I would like to mention one case is between the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia versus Greece over the Macedonia's name. The case has completed its written and oral proceedings, and judgment will be rendered very soon, before the Christmas season. And another case, the case between Germany and Italy on the jurisdictional immunity of state. The case also has finished both oral, written and oral proceedings, and now under the deliberation of the court. And last but not least is the case, all about our contentious cases. And then we have advisor opinion case. The case actually from International Fund for Agricultural Development. The organization has asked court for advisor opinion review of a judgment rendered by the Administrative Tribunal of International Labor Organization, and the case is already under course deliberations. In other words, already in the last stage of its proceedings. From these cases, you can tell that the subject matters and the cases vary greatly, covering wide range of topics. Some of them are really contemporary issues, for instance, jurisdictional immunity and human rights claims and expulsion of the aliens. These are cases actually very much related to the legal development at the stage, and also parties between the before the court come from all continents, and the cases mentioned actually have parties from Africa, Asia, Latin America, Europe, and it's quite a large representation there. And also you may notice the cases mentioned are mostly incidental proceedings. It shows that state parties try to make the best use of the court procedure and really attach importance to the role of the court in the peaceful settlement process. And for the court, oftentimes we have to really work on a parallel basis, oftentimes three cases at one time, and with different subjects. You just try to switch from there to here to there. And for a new judge, a junior judge, it is quite a challenge, I must confess. Court, as I observe, has tried to speed up its work procedure and to raise its efficiency. And you may notice, actually, in the Cambodia versus Thailand case and in the Greece intervention case, court tried to shorten the period for oral proceedings. And in the meantime, the court has also shortened the period between written proceeding and oral proceeding. And therefore, we felt, judges, members of the court, felt really very much squeezed by our time.
Speaking of time.
I have to emphasize, it's the first chair court finally has law clerks working for judges. But as I observe, court still understaffed, and it's really short of human resources and other resources. To my great surprise, as the principal judicial organ is so poorly equipped, I hope it's not in the video, but we made a plea to the General Assembly state parties to help us. But in short, court, as well as members of the institution, are really determined to contribute more to the peaceful settlement of the international dispute. And in retrospect, I think 2011 is a fruitful year. Thank you for your attention.
The organisers for inviting me to this, and above all, the chance to actually hear what everybody else has got to say. I'm providing something of an overview in the fields of the law of armed conflict and human rights law, but not the jus ad bellum, so I won't be dealing with Libya. In addition to looking backwards at things this year, I think it's useful to consider their implications for the future. In other words, to look forwards as well. In both fields, I'm going to have to basically speak in bullet points, but I want to start by, as it were, identifying significant deaths. In the case of the war of armed conflicts, there was Antonio Cassese in September, who was as much known for human rights law, law of armed conflict, and international criminal law. And last Saturday, there was Leslie Green of Canada, an expert in the law of armed conflicts. The first substantive issue I want to touch on is the question of cyber issues. The Foreign Office recently hosted a conference on this and is clearly taking something of a lead on it. It features as part of cyber and freedom of expression, features as part of the programme the Foreign Office has got for its chairmanship for 6 months of the Council of Europe. But next year there's going to be a very interesting document coming out of Estonia, which is the NATO headquarters dealing with cyber issues and situations of conflict. Now, not all cyber issues involve the law of armed conflict, and you can't actually keep them necessarily in rigid boxes. I think the issue of cyber in relation to armed conflicts, which means particularly computer network attacks, does raise a general problem for the law of armed conflict. There is too often a tendency to assume if something's new, you need new law, rather than seeing that, first of all, it may be that existing law is fine, provided you clarify certain notions, and that in the very process of seeking new law, you may undermine existing law if, in fact, it will meet the need. In relation to cyber, I do think we need to clarify the principle of distinction and what it means in relation to computer network attack, and also the principle of proportionality, but more than either of those, we need to sort out what the standard of risk is in relation to the consequences of computer network attack. The second armed conflict thing is actually finishing as we speak, and that's a Red Cross conference. They only happen every 4 or 5 years, and it's a conference of the Red Cross movement as a whole. So you've got the International Committee of the Red Cross, you've got the Federation of National Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies, and states party to the Geneva Conventions. The ICRC has produced two documents for the conference, one on contemporary challenges and another on strengthening protection. Look at the ICRC website, you'll get those documents there, and also the concluding document, which is agenda setting for the movement as a whole. And you'll also find national pledges, some of which are occasionally interesting. A few years ago, the ICRC carried out a survey of in-house of what it saw as problem areas, and from that it identified four. They thought one problem area was the protection of persons and private liberty, another was international mechanisms for monitoring compliance and respect for the rules, a third was the protection of the natural environment, and a fourth was the protection of IDPs, internally displaced persons. The ICRC, being fairly sensible, knowing it couldn't do everything at once, consulted states and said, which of these four do you think are the most important? And slightly surprisingly, the two that states picked, the first is not a surprise, the first was protection of persons deprived of their liberty. It's been a big practical problem, and a particular manifestation of it I'll come back to later. But the second one that states picked was international mechanisms for monitoring compliance. Well, given the reluctance of states to subject themselves to scrutiny, particularly in situations of conflict, it was a bit surprising that they should have picked it. But this is clearly going to be an ICRC issue. It's one of the ones they've identified in their strengthening protection document, and it's going to be the subject of at least some national pledges, most notably the Swiss pledge. Sometimes some states are calling this compliance, which is a very unhelpful word because it's so vague, and sometimes they're calling it implementation, which for me means practical measures ahead of time to give effect to things. In fact, what they seem to be talking about is monitoring conduct during conflicts. And that takes me to the third LOAC development, where the trigger for reflection is a panel of inquiry, the report of a panel of inquiry set up by the Secretary General that reported in September 2011, and which was the third report on the flotilla incident, in other words, involving the blockade of Gaza. Well, first of all, it's amazing that one small incident should trigger three investigations. The first one to report was the Commission of Inquiry set up by the Human Rights Council. They could do it quickly because they're not all that bothered about the law. They make it up as they go along. I've forgotten it's being reported. And basically, that was a traditional, becoming a traditional, Human Rights Council fact-finding mechanism. That reported on the 27th of September 2010. There was then the Turkle Commission. This was an Israeli inquiry assisted by two internationals. One was Brigadier General Ken Watkin, recently retired from the Canadian Defence Forces, and David Trimble, not a renowned expert on the law of armed conflict, even if he's had experience, but it was the other international. They also had international advisors, including Mike Schmidt, who is currently the director of the US Naval War College. So you'd have a Human Rights Council one, then you've got an internal Israeli one with international elements, then you've got a panel of inquiry set up by the Secretary General, where interestingly the members aren't noted law of armed conflict experts, but they produce an exceedingly legal document. If you want something really interesting on blockade, read that. Everything was analysed in terms of blockade. Could they declare a blockade? What are the implications of a blockade, and how do you enforce a blockade? But I think this business of investigating incidents is interesting. I think we're seeing a new trend, and it may be that 2011 is going to be the key year when, looking back, we'll be able to say that's when it became more institutionalised. It's not unique. One of the very early ones that most people have never heard of, and I only know of, unfortunately Kanuma's been warned about this, because it featured in the CUP collection of documents. I want to have a plug for them, please can we have some more? The CUP has produced, thanks to Mark editing them, collections of documents on the conflict in the Gulf of 1990-91 and the one in Liberia, and also the former Yugoslavia and Kosovo. Now, for the famous conflicts, most of the documents most people know of. For Liberia, who the cuckoo knows of any of the documents for Liberia? And some of the other ones contain really unusual things. The Liberia one contains information on the Harbel Camp massacre that I've never seen referred to anywhere else. And it was a really interesting use of an investigation. So it's not unprecedented to have bits of the UN carrying out investigations. But you're getting an increased use, particularly by the Human Rights Council, and particularly where the thing being investigated is something that's occurred in a situation of conflict. Now, needless to say, since it's the Human Rights Council, it's not consistent. So you might have thought that that the end of the conflict in Sri Lanka might have justified some form of investigation, but when they had a special session, all they did was congratulate Sri Lanka on the end of the conflict. So it's very patchy when they'll do it, but the Human Rights Council is doing it more often, and that, I think, is a problem. These three reports aren't identical in their conclusions. And perhaps more worryingly, the two international ones aren't. That's partly because the Human Rights Council doesn't know how to use the law of armed conflict when it's dealing with these things. That's partly an issue of expertise, and it's also a question of how should the analysis proceed. And looking forward, I think it would be useful if there was a special rapporteur on the law of armed conflict whose function would be to assist any other special rapporteur looking at something in a situation of conflict. And I think it would be useful if in any of these inquiries they automatically use a member of the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission, first of all to give them some experience, because nobody's ever used them as a body, but secondly to actually get some genuine law of armed conflict expertise there. So the issue of investigations in law of armed conflict terms is an interesting one. Things seem to be changing. And now I've got a bridge between law of armed conflict and human rights law, because it involves both and also ICL, and this is the Germany-Italy case. For some reason, NGOs are getting involved, and how they think they can contribute to the deliberations is completely unclear to me. I think there is a big risk that the court, it's a bit disconcerting having folk who appear before the ICJ and an ICJ judge here, I think there's a danger that the court will think that if it has to give an answer, yes or no. Because I think the answer no would do in the level of supporting Germany, i.e. Italy was not allowed to trump sovereign immunity. I think if there's just an absolute no, that would represent a step backwards. I would suggest what the position should be is that if states have concluded a deal at the end of an armed conflict dealing with compensation, then if but only if it expressly addresses individual compensation, compensation owed to individuals and not the state, and if it makes clear that the state receiving the money has to disburse this, then you no longer have a claim against the perpetrator state. Your claim is against the state that received the money. Also, I think it would be useful if they said, sovereign immunity is not a cloak for impunity. Therefore, if you can sue in the courts of the state against which you want to bring a complaint, then sovereign immunity must prevail. Otherwise, if you can't effectively sue there, then you ought to be able to bring a proceeding. But that may be for the future. The law 3945 was not that, but I think we're in a different place. That's my bridge into human rights law. The obvious thing to refer to in human rights law, besides which Michael would be most disappointed if I didn't, is Alskane in Algeria. The Ministry of Defence is acting as if it's the end of the world and the sky's fallen in, which is slightly puzzling, but it's having an effect on the attitude taken by the military. Algeria was the case on unlawful detention, where the European Court of Human Rights said it wasn't covered by Article 5, and it wasn't required by a binding Security Council resolution. Alskane was the case concerning whether or not there is a need to investigate deaths caused during the course of a belligerent occupation, where the key issue was whether the victims were within the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom. There are two different questions. Is there a problem with the substance of what the court found, and how did they get there? As far as Al-Jeddah is concerned, I have no problem with the substance of the judgment, because Article 103 of the UN Charter only kicks in when there's a conflict between a binding Security Council resolution and some other international legal obligation, not simply because both exist. And all the Security Council resolution did was authorise detention. It didn't make it mandatory. And the preambles of the Security Council resolutions also referred to the need to comply with human rights and humanitarian law. So the fact that they were told, no, you're required to comply with the Convention and the Security Council resolution doesn't justify the departure, I don't have a problem with. I probably don't have a problem with the result in Alskane, but it depends on what the court turns out to mean by investigating. In all the individual cases, because the circumstances were different, it's Alskane and others, they found that the victim was within the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom because the UK exercised the requisite control at the relevant time and place. Now, I think there's a difference in the situations where you've got an individual being frog-marched between members of the British Armed Forces and forced into a canal when they couldn't swim, that's control. A roadblock, that's control. I have more difficulties with the search of a house where you don't have a clue what's going to go on, but I suppose you could see that as being within the control because you control the external perimeters. But what's going to be really important is knowing how much they expect in the way of an investigation. They need to be realistic about what you can and can't do in a situation of contested occupation. How did they get there? Now, I haven't seen the British government's pleadings. I've only read the judgment. But inferring from what the summary in the judgment of the British government's argument, no wonder they lost. Someone should be shot for idiotic pleadings. It would appear that in Al-Jeddah they said, Security Council resolution and we don't need to look at anything else. So no fallback position, no how about the use of customary humanitarian law, something like that, and getting the court to apply that. They put all their eggs into a foreseeably leaking basket. In Alskane, they appear to have gone one stage worse. They didn't even use a proper legal argument. They say, you dare stick your noses into this, that will be a form of imperialism, and I'll never talk to you again. If you don't believe me, read the second opinion of one judge who must have been demon happy, who says at the end, what if I'm being accused of being a human rights imperialist and a lot worse charges? I think some alternative pleading would have come in useful, and it would have also been extremely useful if they had consulted the Army Legal Service. This is not the Foreign Office fault, it's the fault of the Civilian Legal Advisor in MOD, who will not allow the Foreign Office ever to talk to Army lawyers. The advantage of talking to army lawyers is they would say, here is our bottom line, and this is why it's our bottom line. You can argue for other fancy things, but we must have this bit. Because in that case, you'd be able to convey that to the court. And it would give the court better guidance than simply telling them to keep their noses out or something. Very briefly,
yes.
Keep an eye on keep an eye on Georgia Russia number two. We've had the admissibility hearing, that's the one about the conduct of hostilities. I haven't been able to find out, even from the Deputy Registrar of the Court, when we're likely to get the admissibility results, but it's going to be interesting. That's effectively Son of Bankovic. And finally, the reform of the ECHR. The UK, the next 6 months, is chairing the Council of Europe. And that's one of the issues they're looking at. I think there is a concern on the part of human rights activists that they're looking in the wrong place for solutions. They keep saying the court's a victim of its own success. It isn't. It's a victim of state failure to give effect domestically to the European Convention on Human Rights. The problems largely aren't with the court. They're with what's happening, the three areas of problem. National judges aren't interpreting aren't applying the convention and in using the case law in doing so, the case law of the convention. Second, when judgments come out, some countries are bad about giving them effect. And if you want to get rid of the obviously inadmissible cases, I suggest a system of licensing lawyers. You can only apply using a lawyer. There would be no fixed maximum number of these licenses, but they would be trained, they would get a license and authority to submit cases, and if in two successive years more than 20% of their cases were inadmissible, they'd lose their license. The reason for suggesting that is it puts a filter in the hands of people who are applicant-minded. I don't want the filter to be in the hands of people who are government-minded. Over to Michael.
Talk about effective pleas or ineffective pleas. I will give you an example of a highly effective plea. I plead innocence. I am not guilty. And if you just look at me, you can agree that I, James, would be the very last person to oppose a decent spread of sandwiches on Fridays. So I reclaim my minute and demand an extra one.
You have 2 minutes.
By way of additional competition. On the other issue, though, the other complaint raised by James, I cannot oppose it. He is right. As soon as my hands sign on the dotted lines to work with the United Nations this year on peace settlements around the world, that very moment is the moment when the Arab Spring broke out. I was used in previous practice to work on things like traditional internal armed conflicts, difficult cases like Somalia, or recently Sudan, cases of secession or regionalism in Darfur. But much of this work has indeed been dedicated to attempting to support transitions. What I will attempt to give you here today is merely a bird's eye view. Obviously, I will not address any of the details, or do it in a way that is, as James said, attributable to the United Nations. I will very briefly revisit the democratic norms, democratic transitions, after all, is what we're talking about. What are the elements of transitions that we would normally expect to see? And what are the kind of different types of transitions that the Arab Spring has helped us to recognize? What are the modalities for the involvement of international actors in a process as delicate as some of these instances, ranging from advice to armed intervention? And finally, if James gives me my additional minute, what are the implications of this for international law? Let me start with the UN Declaration on Human Rights of 1948. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government. The will of the people is the basis of the authority of government. Now, this does seem to be an obvious statement, but it is one which, of course, since the very moment when it was uttered in 1948, could not really be universally honored. because we entered the Cold War era, and the Cold War was essentially a conflict about how do we assess the will of the people and how do we constitute government on the basis of it. A profound ideological conflict where we had these two sides arguing opposing positions and doing it to the point of bringing us close to a global armed confrontation. In view of this fact, it was found simply convenient to revert to the previous legal position, which was not one that tried to judge the legitimacy of governance based on whether or not a particular government can claim genuinely to be based on the will of the people. But it was a return to the Tinoco arbitration of 1923. The issue is not whether the new government assumes power or conducts its administration under constitutional limitations established by the people, the umpire said. The question is, has the government really established itself in such a way that all within its influence recognize its control and that there is no opposing force assuming to be a government in its place? The criterion of effectiveness continued to govern decisions on who we treat as a government in place in a given territory, who has supreme power within that territory to govern, and who can exclusively represent people or populations and the territory externally. But with the end of the Cold War, obviously, a new chance arose to revisit the principle that the authority to govern must be based on the will of the people. And there was a rush in the UN General Assembly and elsewhere to reconsecrate this principle as a fundamental norm of international life. Not only the UN General Assembly reconsecrated it, we had the Organization of American States, the OCE, or there was the CSCE, the Organization of African Unity, and now the African Union. In relation to Haiti, we had the UN Security Council authorize the use of all necessary measures, the use of force, to restore a democratic government, the government of President Aristide, that had been displaced through a counter-constitutional coup immediately after it had been democratically elected. And while most of you may think that since then has been fairly quiet in terms of pro-democratic action, that is actually not quite true. There's vast international practice, mainly in Africa, administered by the African Union and sub-regional organizations, in terms of at times enforceable action to oppose counter-constitutional coups, and more recently, to vindicate contested electoral results. Even this year, when I signed on the dotted line, there was an armed intervention to ensure that the government that had been very narrowly and controversially elected in Côte d'Ivoire could assume power when the incumbent president forcibly resisted the implementation of the electoral result. Quite, in a way, quite a dramatic development, but it was almost unnoticed on the international scene. So this, as it were, is the background to increasing interest in actioning the principle that the authority to govern must be based on the will of the people. And then we had the transitions of the so-called Arab Spring. Now, traditionally, what do transitions consist of? We will have often violent political change or agreed political change. The first thing you will find, there will be a government of national unity. There will be a pledge to achieve immediate improvements in terms of the delivery of governance, immediate compliance with human rights, release of detainees, no more torture, and so forth. A pledge to early elections, maybe a national dialogue process, maybe transitional justice, and inevitably constitutional drafting, followed by a new round of elections. Often this entire process will be supported by complex peacekeeping operations. And we had all of this and had plenty of experience of it in the transitions that followed upon the end of the Cold War, Mozambique, Angola, Cambodia, Namibia, Central America, a very large number of cases of this kind. But of course, the Arab Spring was slightly different. It came suddenly, and it came in an environment where even those who would benefit from international supported assistance advice in managing a transition were at times quite resistant to it. the MENA regions, Middle East, North Africa, a region that is not very keen on outsiders being involved in seeking to organize political futures for that region. Now, what were the particular difficult and different types of transitions that we encountered? The first one is the so-called regime-led transition. You have an uprising, a campaign for change, and the government, more or less reluctantly, agrees to answer the call for change. This will only work where the regime inspires sufficient confidence that it is really willing to offer the change that the opposition seeks, and the opposition is willing to have confidence in this process, is willing to go along by a transition that is led by the regime. One of the examples is Morocco, where we have an offer from the government to negotiate gradually a transition, not a case that has triggered significant international involvement. The next case is more difficult, a so-called protected transition. This is the case where you start a negotiating process about a transition, it doesn't work, there's great pressure of change. For instance, in Egypt, President Mubarak offered change. He in fact had offered an avenue of renegotiating the political order of Egypt that might have been more beneficial to the demonstrators than what ultimately transpired. But there was an immediate demand for a resignation of the president and rapid immediate change that led to the takeover by the military. The military, in that case, being a trusted institution of state, as it were, rather than the natural enemy of a democratic opposition. And at that point, being trusted to help manage a transition, protecting the process of change. In Yemen, more recently, we have one half of the armed forces, the first armored brigade, siding with the democratic opposition and purportedly protecting it. But the advice to you, if you are a democratic demonstrator, is beware of armored brigades trying to protect you. There can be other agendas that are being pursued. And the third case is restricted transition. Bahrain. We have an external armed force that involves itself in order to stabilize the existing government, and that government then offers a very limiting process of renegotiating the transition. So these are all different types of a regime-led transition which we have been able to look at. The next type would be a technocratic transition. Here you have the fall of government and political space that emerges is administered neutrally by those beyond suspicion of long-term political ambitions. Now, 84 would be no age for academics who are young, of course, at that point. But the interim prime minister of Tunisia at the age of 84 was chosen because it was felt that his long-term horizon for his political ambitions might after all be limited. He would, in a way, be a sort of fairly neutral figure. Then there are power-sharing transitions. You have the opposing forces who agree to divide the pie during the transitional period and work together to administer the transition. Now, if you have opponents and put them straight into a government and say, you are now the best of friends, you will run the transition together, is that likely to work very well? Probably not. The opponents will remain opponents competing for power at the end of the transition.
Mark, there's
and
one
these
other,
kind of power-sharing elements...
There's one other transition to the next speaker.
And the Christian man who is. I am... nearly moving.
I'll give you a last minute.
Good one. And then finally we have the opposition-led straight victory of a revolutionary movement, Libya, although with a helping hand from someone else. I was going to speak a little bit about international involvement and different types of involvement, but I'll keep that very short. We've had some instances where there has been hardly any involvement. Morocco, Bahrain, where involvement has been curtailed, other than through a commission of inquiry that looked at the violence in the initial phase of the attempted transition. We had international facilitation in Yemen, where it was crucial first to have a regional initiative that paved the way for the UN and other actors to become active. And then we have, possibly an imposed transition or enforced transition in relation to Libya, where we've had a UN mandate granted for humanitarian purposes relating to the protection of civilians and civilian populations, and a mandate that seemed to flow towards the aim of regime change. Now, I will leave out other important sections of my presentation and instead come to my conclusion. We can definitely observe, and it will be interesting to hear James's view, because when he came in as the Hewitt Professor here, his inaugural lecture was on democracy and international law, and rightly at that time, he was hesitant about the relevance of that doctrine to international law proper. But I think now, after some 15 years or so of further practice, we can see that the democratic norm does have relevance. It may not be one that is immediately enforceable in order to have all of us enjoy the benefits of a Western-style democracy, but there is legal meaning to it, at least in cases of counter-constitutional coups and in cases where an electoral result is evident but is not respected. The Arab Spring has added to that, at least the political recognition of the legitimacy of pro-democratic movements and indeed pro-democratic revolutions. President al-Saleh of Yemen was duly elected. He had two more years to run in his terms. Nevertheless, the UN Security Council called upon him to effect a transition, basically to resign. And we have a number of cases and lessons on how one can best support the administration of transitions of this kind, but these lessons will forever remain mysterious to you because I shall ask you for proof.
When Mark says that something will forever remain mysterious, take him not at his word, and he'll say it again next time. Michael.
Thank you very much. I won't rise to Francois Hutchinson's bait about Jeddah and Askeni, only to say that I don't necessarily agree with everything he said about it. And I also plead not guilty, since I was not involved as a Strasbourg stage of that, those cases. I'm going to pick up on three matters which haven't been touched on. Firstly, to say that I think this was a very good year for the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea in Hamburg. It dealt with two important cases. Firstly, in February, it issued an advisory opinion on the responsibilities of states, its sponsor entities, to engage in deep seabed mining. This was a first for the tribunal. It was a unanimous advisory opinion, and I think a very good one. About 15 states took part in the written and oral stage, and it showed that tribunal is capable of giving quite detailed advice to the International Seabed Authority in Kingston. And the second case was the hearing in September, which James and I attended on opposite sides, in the delimitation case in the Bay of Bengal between Bangladesh and Myanmar. This is the first delimitation case that has gone to Hamburg rather than to arbitration or to the International Court of Justice. Judgment is expected. They've set a provisional date for the 14th of March 2012. For the judgment, and it'll be very interesting, but it's a very important case for the tribunal, and I think it does show that there is scope for development in the work of that court, which so far hasn't had that much to do. And I must say, I think they organised the hearing extremely well. I think all the counsel and the parties were very satisfied indeed with the way it was organised. So there is an alternative. The Hague. I'm not saying it's better, but it's an alternative, and it is specialist in the North Sea. I think it was an interesting year for immunities. And I'll just mention a few developments. Firstly, both France and Spain have ratified the UN Convention on the Immunities of States, That's a very important convention adopted in 2004, which is not yet in force, but it is gradually building up the support necessary for it to come into force. We've already heard reference to the important case at the International Court of Justice. But I wanted to mention a case in the English court. One's view of the law is a bit subjective. One's view of the year depends on what you've been doing, I suppose. But this was a case called Kurz Bat against federal judge of the Germany. It was an extradition case. Kurz Bat was a Mongolian official who was wanted in Germany for kidnapping and severe ill-treatment. Eli Lauterpacht appeared for the government of Mongolia, and I appeared rather curiously for the Foreign Office, who got themselves involved in the case for some reason. The court dealt with three matters. It considered the customary international law on special missions. This was the High Court in London. Because Mr. Kurzbach claimed he was on a special mission to have talks with the British National Security Council. It dealt secondly with the immunity rationi personae of holders of high office in the state, like heads of state, heads of government, foreign ministers, and possibly others, because he claimed he was in this category. And thirdly, and most interestingly perhaps, it dealt with official act immunity, because on the second day of the hearing, the Republic of Mongolia said that the kidnapping and ill-treatment were official acts of the government of Mongolia for which there should be immunity. The High Court rejected all three claims to immunity. Mr. Kurzbach did not appeal and was therefore returned to Germany, where, somewhat to our surprise, he was released about 2 weeks later. I don't know why. The third and last point I want to touch on is the International Law Commission. It had quite a productive year, as it should in the fifth year of a five-year term. It tries to conclude its work on various topics. I am developing a thesis which says the International Law Commission is quite a dangerous place. I think it's dangerous because its work is often given too much respect. It's given great weight. For example, the International Court in the Nagy-Murus case found that its draft article on necessity was customary law, reflected customary law. I think one should look very critically at the work of the International Law Commission. And I want to take, by way of example, the project that it concluded this year on the responsibility of international organisations. This, it concluded the project, it adopted on second reading 67 draft articles, most of which are very familiar to those who know the draft articles on the responsibility of states. The draft articles are accompanied by commentaries, and I can't emphasise too much the importance of the commentaries in any text that the International Law Commission comes up with. You can't really understand the text just by looking at the articles. They have to be read together with the equally important, in my view, commentaries. The commentaries on this occasion are rather short. The Special Rapporteur Geyer seemed to think that we could just refer to Special Rapporteur Crawford's commentaries on state responsibility, and we did in large measure. There's a third element, though, which is very important, and this is a general commentary that was placed at the start of these draft articles. And I just want to mention three quick points from that general commentary, because they try to give a flavour of the status of these draft articles. Firstly, there's a statement that says, nothing in the draft article should be read as implying the existence or otherwise of any particular primary rule binding on international organisations. That reflects the very interesting question, what rules of international law bind international organisations? To what extent is an international organisation bound by customary international law, custody of international law of human rights. That's the point we made there. Secondly, in turning to the status, it says the fact that several of the articles are based on limited practice moves the border between codification and progressive development in the direction of progressive development. It may occur that a provision in the state responsibility articles could be regarded as representing codification, while the corresponding provision in these articles is more in the nature of progressive development. In other words, the provisions of the present draft articles do not necessarily yet have the same authority as the corresponding provisions on state responsibility. As was also the case with the articles on state responsibility, their authority will depend upon the reception by those to whom they are addressed. And I think that's very important. The authority of the product of the International Law Commission doesn't depend just on its own standing, that can some way perhaps, but what really matters is the reception of its work by states and others. And the third important point that's made in this general commentary, it says the diversity of international organisations. After all, international organisations are not states. They're very different from states. But also, they're very different from each other. No two international organisations are the same. And it says the diversity of international organisations may affect the application of certain articles, some of which may not apply to certain international organisations in light of their powers and functions. I think the European Union is probably quite happy to see that sentence here. Generally speaking, international organisations were very reserved about these articles. It's easy to see why, I think, but a sort of underlying feeling on the part of some of them is that we shouldn't really talk about the responsibility of international organisations, because if we do, they might be held to be responsible. They just don't like that. The World Bank, for example, says it will have a chilling effect on its assistance to countries if the aid and assistance article here could possibly apply to it. So there's a feeling on the part of international organisations that they'd rather not be bound by international law. I'll stop at that point.
I wrote four wonderful reviews of what has been happening and that you should take note of for the examination and other purposes. Now, I'm sure there'll be questions.